This is The Guardian.
Today, the death of an activist in the UK takes us back into the world of a powerful phone hacking tool. A couple of months ago, we brought you an investigation that might have left you a little paranoid about your phone.
A data leak suggests that activists, politicians and journalists around the world may have been monitored using mobile phone spyware designed to target...
It was about a powerful spyware tool called Pegasus, created by an Israeli company and sold to governments around the world.
The Pegasus software, which has been sold to countries including Saudi Arabia and Bahrain, has been widely misused.
In their hands, it had become a weapon used against journalists, human rights activists, lawyers, maybe even world leaders. And we had a leak, a database of 50,000 phone numbers, giving clues as to who some of those victims could be.
French President Emmanuel Macron has called for a series of investigations into the Pegasus spyware case. It follows reports that his phone number was on a list of potential targets.
We spent months trying to match leaked phone numbers to real people. One of those matches came in the very last weeks of the investigation, and in the most tragic way.
Tragic news arises from London, where Emirati dissident and activist Ala al-Sadiq was killed in a fatal car crash yesterday.
Ala al-Sadiq was a dissident from the United Arab Emirates. She had sought asylum in London. In early July, she died in a car accident. Nobody thinks her death was suspicious, but there was a lot about her story that was. After the first round of Pegasus stories was over, most of us moved on to other things. But the lead reporter on the project, Stephanie Kishgusner, couldn't let Ala go.
It was strange and sad. And I also really felt like we really need to tell this woman's story. I think, Mike, you probably got a flurry of emails from me or messages, and so did the other consortium members.
She kept looking for threads to pull. What she found took us right back into this world of paranoia, espionage, and repression across borders. All of it made possible by a private spyware industry that helped governments steal secrets, but which now was finding its own splashed across front pages around the world. From The Guardian, I'm Michael Safi. Today in Focus, hacked in London. The story of Ala al-Sadiq, one of the earliest Pegasus infections ever detected. Steph, when did you first hear of Ala al-Sadiq's death?
Well, it was a weekend and I was actually at home. And at that time, it was in June, I was working at home most weekends on the Pegasus project. So I remember very distinctly, I was sitting at my dining room table and I saw the news that an Emirati activist had been killed in a car accident in Oxford, and that it was a young woman who had died.
This is worth saying again. Nobody thinks her death is suspicious. Not Ala's friends, not the police. It was a collision involving two cars, and people in both of them were hurt in the accident. Ala was the only one who died.
So the news of Ala's death, it really struck me. And I also was really curious because so many of the numbers that we had looked at were numbers in the UK, and many of them dissidents. And I knew that, obviously from this news story of this young woman being killed, that this was an Emirati activist who was living, in exile in the UK. I really became curious about whether she was in our data.
Yeah, because there were hundreds of phone numbers to which we hadn't attached names. We just didn't know who these people were. And so you tried Ala's numbers in the database.
Yeah, well, I didn't have her numbers. So the first thing I did was I contacted a source of mine in Washington who may have known her. And he did know her and he was really, in a state of shock at her death. And I did ask whether he had her phone numbers because I wanted to check. And I told him I had a way to check whether she might have been a possible surveillance target. And so he sent me her numbers. And I remember I was inserting them in the data to see if a match would come up. And sure enough, two of the three numbers that he had given me were in the data.
This activist, whose death is a national news story, she's in the database. She might have been hacked. Working with Amnesty International, we had the capacity to check if a phone had been infected with Pegasus. At the time, it was too difficult. We had Alaa's numbers, but not her actual phones. But when Steph started digging, she found out someone had already tested Alaa's phones. It was a Canadian group called Citizen Lab that specializes in these sorts of investigations. Their tests came back positive. An NSO client had been watching Alaa for years, and now Alaa knew it. And that wasn't all.
The other thing that was truly kind of new to me was that Alaa had given an interview to a group called Forensic Architecture.
Maybe how did you find out that this happened, when? So that we can understand better.
Yes, on 12th of July, I have noticed that my phone just hanged or keep buffering while I am using the WhatsApp.
Which had done this massive, report and project detailing, allegations of abuse using Pegasus. And so I was able to actually listen to that interview after her next of kin, gave Forensic Architecture the permission for us to hear it and to use it.
I felt so stressful, and then I freaked out almost. But I was trying to gather myself. And
I mean, the fact that she'd been, that her phone had been examined by Citizen Lab was really important, and it was important for several reasons. First of all, because it showed us that she knew that she had been the victim of hacking and that she had lived with that in the last, she lived with that knowledge in the last 12 months of her life.
I'm not afraid of other things about me, but about others, because in this case, unfortunately, this kind of violations cannot be... It's not changeable, and I cannot protect them. So this is it's a very sad thing to feel.
Steph, at this time, how much did you know about Alaa El-Sadiq?
I did not know much at all. I think what I found out later was really kind of eye-opening about what her life experience had been. Beginning with the fact that her father is a very well-known political prisoner in the UAE.
Now he's in a jail for a very long time, and no one even knows about him. And this is very sad because he might be forgotten. And also,
she was motivated both by bringing, both by a few things, but one of them was bringing attention to his case. But then that becomes a much broader kind of campaign for justice and for human rights, and to bring attention to human rights abuses more generally in the region.
Alaa, who was 33 when she died, came from a family who pushed for democracy in a country whose governments saw that as a major threat. The UAE imprisoned Alaa's dad, Mohammed El-Sadiq, in a mass trial and then stripped him of his citizenship. They left him stateless and in jail. Worried she'd be arrested too, Alaa left for Qatar, where she tried to rebuild her life. But the UAE wanted her back, and after Qatar refused to hand her over, the UAE revoked her citizenship too, along with those of her 9 siblings. She no longer had a passport. UAE newspapers started referring to her as a terrorist. But she wanted to keep pushing for democracy, human rights, so she moved to London, thinking, surely there, she'd be out of reach. Over the past few years, she had started making her life over again, getting a job, making friends, including someone who's asked us not to give her full name. We're going to call her N. We've also disguised her voice. What were your first impressions of her?
We clicked immediately. We both grew up in a conservative community in the Middle East. We're not from the same countries. But we had a lot of similar things, to be women in the Middle East, to have to find your place in a Western society that does not, sometimes it feels like we don't fit exactly here, but also we felt we don't fit exactly back at home. She's, so funny, charming. She was very caring. I considered her home to be, my second home in London. She understood how is it like to be in exile, to be on your own without your family and also have to be independent and to stand for your values, to work hard. She connected me to her friends also in the city, and we continued to be friends since that day.
Did she often talk about her country? And when she did, what did she say?
She talked about her country a lot. She loved her country. She always spoke about how much she missed it, how much she hopes she can go back. She was from Sharjah. She talked a lot about the sea there. And for the last year or longer during the lockdown, she was hoping to be able to go to the sea again because she was so attached to it in her country.
When Alaa made it to London, do you think she felt safe there, that she was out of the reach of the Emirati government?
No, I don't think so. She knew that they can keep track of her whenever she goes. And even on the way she moved in the city, she was very careful not to take one train. She keeps changing the train. She keeps looking behind her that if there's anyone following her. Whenever we go to the park, we would joke with her, "Is who's following you today?" Yeah, so there was this sense of surveillance all the time, but she did not let it get into her. She was so determined that this does not affect her life, that she liked to go out all the time to meet friends. She liked to cycle a lot in the city, even when we felt like this may be dangerous. But she did not want anyone or anything to dictate the way she should live her life.
Changing trains, always looking behind her. She was still in touch with activists and dissidents in the UAE. And one day she wondered, could she trust her phone? So she gets in touch with Bill Marzak, a senior investigator with that digital research group, Citizen Lab. Here's Stephanie Kishgusner again.
What I heard was that basically in January of 2020, Alaa reaches out to Citizen Lab, and Citizen Lab agrees to put basically a monitoring app on her phone. And what that does, it basically allows these researchers to kind of see if there's anything amiss on the phone, if there's any kind of intrusion. So months go by and there's nothing. And then suddenly, as Bill described it to me from Citizen Lab, in that summer, the summer of 2020, they see that there is, in fact, an infection on her phone. And from that moment, they see this kind of relentless attempts and successfully getting onto her phone. He described it as a 24/7 attempt to hack her and to surveil her. And so that prompts Citizen Lab to take a look at her other devices and an older phone, including the one that she used when she was in Qatar. And sure enough, they find SMS messages on those phones that are linked to the Pegasus spyware. And this was the same numbers that were in our database.
Alaa's phone had been watched relentlessly for years using Pegasus, a tool that gives foreign governments complete access to your phone. Photos, messages, phone calls. It can even turn your device into a microphone, live in your house, hearing everything. Citizen Lab couldn't say with certainty which NSO client was doing the hacking, though Alaa strongly suspected it was a government in the UAE. Their embassy in Washington didn't respond to our questions about her case or her hacking. Alaa's phone had been infected, first while she was in Qatar, and then, crucially, while she was in London. Being in the UK was no protection. Her case was remarkable for another reason, too.
Something actually that was, I think it was forensic architecture mentioned to me that also made me pause. And, you know, I am someone who's been writing about this topic a lot, but they said, you know, we think she's one of the first victims, known victims of Pegasus.
This pressure she was under, I mean, the revelation that she had had her phone hacked potentially for years before, did that continue until her death? Did she ever get relief from that feeling of being watched?
I know that in the week before she died, as she's preparing for this trip to Oxford for like a fun birthday weekend, that among the things, you know, on her kind of mental checklist is what are the devices that I'm going to take with me? Because I don't want to be monitored while I'm on this weekend away.
Before the weekend where she died in a car accident, her birthday weekend, Alaa's checklist had included where to go, what to pack, and which of her phones was least likely to be infected with Pegasus. Her friend, N, was there that weekend.
It was the day after her birthday. We had we were going to the countryside outside of Oxford. We were four friends together, and then we wanted to go away for the weekend to celebrate her birthday. And she was so full of energy. She was like, she was so happy that day.
I'm sorry, and it must be so hard to talk about.
It is hard to talk about, but one of the things that brought us comfort, the fact that we had an amazing day. It was a very lovely afternoon. She said it was the happiest day of her life. Even the day before, during her birthday, she was at peace. She said things that 33 is the best age. She looks at her life and she feels that she has already fulfilled a lot of her dreams. And we had great time that day. We went to a playground and we played like children, yeah, all of us. So we have videos of her laughing so hard, smiling all the time. So it was like a very nice day, and I'm grateful for that. Like, her last day was this happy that she was surrounded with people who loved her so much. But it was not supposed to end this way. We were on our way back to the hotel. We all bought gifts to give her, and we had a dinner prepared and a birthday cake at the hotel waiting for us. And we were 6 minutes away, and then we were on a small road on the countryside. There was a junction, and then there was a Land Rover coming from the left. Alaa was sitting on the back seat on the left. For a moment, there was a second when I hoped that we will escape each other, but then the other car collided to ours from her direction. And our car slided to a field close to the road. And Alaa passed away at the scene.
And one of the things that I was talking to Steph earlier, and she told me that even after Alaa had died, that the fear and the kind of surveillance and all of this stuff, that even in her death, that wasn't gone.
True. Absolutely. She was discharged from the hospital on the 25th of June, and then she was taken to the mosque. The plan was to take her to Qatar because her family wanted her to be buried there. So it was our only chance to go and see her in the mosque. I'm grateful I was able to go and say my goodbye, but some of our closest friends had to stay away from the mosque. They wanted to be like to come as close as possible, but they did not feel safe to enter and to say their goodbyes. My friend told me like to say goodbye on her behalf, on her behalf, and this was very painful, as if Allah passing away is not enough already, even in like in these hard moments when we needed to be with her and to be with each other, we were not able to do so. So for me, the surveillance continues even after her death, and we carry its burden now. The fact that I'm staying anonymous, yeah, like it says something about the sense of fear that this surveillance created not only for her, but for the people around her as well.
What do you hope that Allah will be remembered for?
She was so caring, so much fun to be around. I had a feeling that she was happy, she was content. Most of the time, she did not allow herself to fall into depression or to be a victim of this. Even like a victim of being stateless or like to feel like a refugee. She was planning to do a PhD. She was ready to stand for and fight for any cause by all means, whether a tweet or to go to a march or a protest or to join a panel. Even like when it was not possible to see results, yeah? In most of like these fights, these like we don't see any results, but this did not stop her as well. Like she knew that she has to do her part in this.
Allah's story was brought to light by Forensic Architecture, the London-based research group who interviewed her last year and shared the audio with us. Shuri C. Malavi was one of the researchers who interviewed Allah for that project.
A lot of what I learned from this project has to do with the way that digital violence complements traditional forms of state violence. So we're used to activists being arrested, interrogated, tortured, intimidated, having their offices broken into, lawsuits, being slandered. These are traditional forms of state violence, corporate violence that civil society around the world face. But when it comes to digital violence, we don't have the language. We don't have the security protocols in activist communities yet. We don't have the legal forums to take to account groups like NSO Group, software like Pegasus. This violence is done through malware that's so advanced that it makes the detection difficult. It makes our ability to protect ourselves almost impossible. So what I learned is that we've entered into an entirely new terrain of warfare against human rights work around the world.
Do you believe that there is anything that government can do to kind of put this genie back in the bottle? And I'm talking about the UN and multilateral institutions, or is this something we have to simply accept is now a feature of the world?
I don't think we need to accept this as a feature of the world in the way that we don't have to accept other forms of state violence as a simple feature of the world. I think what we have to do is to remain vigilant and to nip this in the bud at this point where we see the damage that it's doing. We are at a point now where we have however limited tools to detect this malware. We have enough cases, enough patterns in front of us of how this malware is used to silence and intimidate civil society work. So now is really the moment to act. And now is the moment to prevent the proliferation of these weapons before it gets completely out of control.
Coming up, what's changed since we published the Pegasus Project? Stay with us. Steph, the Pegasus Project is continuing to have an impact. We've seen just in the last few days a media report that the French government's investigation into some of our stories has discovered traces of Pegasus on the phones of 5 French ministers. Now, we don't know if they were successfully hacked, but still astonishing. And NSO continues to deny that any French ministers were hacked using Pegasus. But beyond that, what kinds of reactions have we been seeing in the world since those stories went live?
I would say one of the most significant reactions, in fact, it's still sort of a breaking story, is that we have seen a pretty strong reaction in Europe and the European Commission level.
This is a whole industry gone rogue. In a deadly alliance with the worst dictators of this world, making human rights work impossible. We need a global ban on the export of these kinds of spyware, and we need to ask the tough questions to other governments, including those in Israel and Saudi Arabia.
In the US, we saw there was a high-level Biden administration official who reportedly raised the issue with an Israeli counterpart. And I know there are continuing to be reverberations in India and in Mexico. So it's definitely a story, a group of stories that kind of are on the radar now. That's, you know, spyware and the issue of spyware is on the radar.
It's really clear from Alaa's story, from all the revelations of the Pegasus Project, that NSO software is routinely used by its government clients against people who couldn't be called terrorists or criminals by any stretch of the imagination. How has the company reacted to this continuing onslaught of stories?
Well, the company has really vociferously denied that it has anything to do with the database. They really strenuously deny that. And then now they kind of have fallen back on some of their kind of talking points they used before the project, which is just that they are an important resource for crime fighting by legitimate law enforcement and government agencies. And that's work that they can't talk about.
And so when they're presented with evidence that a government is misusing this software, they say that they investigate it and governments can actually lose access to the software. Do we know that that's happened in response to any of these stories that have been put out there by the Pegasus Project and since?
We've reported that Saudi Arabia has been dropped as a client, and we've reported that Dubai has been dropped as a client. And we do have reason to think those are related to cases of, you know, alleged abuse by those government clients.
And what about the big tech companies, companies like Apple? Have they reacted to the vulnerabilities that have been exposed in their systems?
Actually, one thing that's happened in the last few weeks is that Citizen Lab came out and announced that they had discovered, in effect, the kind of code of an exploit. Now, this was an exploit that we had been looking at that was kind of hacking the most up-to-date Apple iPhones. So what that means is that Citizen Lab shared that information with Apple, and Apple created a patch to fix that exploit within days. Citizen Lab said that that was a bad day for NSO. So everyone, by the way, should update their phones.
Ultimately, NSO can only export this software if they're licensed to do so by the Israeli government. And on that side of things, have we seen any action? Are they showing that they're serious about cracking down on abuse using Pegasus?
No. In fact, a contact of mine was pointing out to me that, you know, if they wanted to, if some of these countries have proven to have abused their software licenses, you know, and used the software in ways that they're not supposed to, use the spyware in ways they're not supposed to, then Israel as a state could probably, you know, take some action against those countries. We have not seen anything like that happen. I think there was a pretty strong reaction to our reporting project. And, you know, there have been some statements from Israel about wanting to examine these allegations, but we have not seen more since then.
Steph, thanks so much.
Thanks, Mike.
NSO has said its spyware is meant to be used by governments and law enforcement agencies to investigate serious crimes, not to target journalists and activists. It's also said it investigates allegations of abuse of its technology. NSO requested that The Guardian provide it with the numbers Alaa was using when she was hacked. In response, they said, quote, "As always, when we get credible information on an alleged misuse, we conduct a thorough investigation and act upon the findings." That was Stephanie Kirsch-Gussner, an investigative reporter with The Guardian. You can read Steph's story about Alaa at theguardian.com, along with all our stories from the Pegasus Project. And our five-part series on the project also is available there and wherever you get your podcasts. That is all for today. The interview that you heard with Alaa was conducted by the filmmaker Laura Poitras and shared with us by Forensic Architecture. Original music and sound design by Axel Cacoutier. And the executive producers are Phil Maynard and Archie Bland. Back Tuesday.
This is The Guardian.